Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. Very much enjoying listening to your episode regarding airport security in Israel and the concept of an invisible perimeter and various advanced sensing technologies that are coming to market. And it made me think of a topic that I was on in two minds as to whether or not it would be a good idea to bring into the podcast. But I think if we don't cover it once, I will regret it. And that is the tragic events of October the 7th, 2023, which in Israel have, I think, just reshaped so much about the country, not just militarily, but changed the whole dynamic, I think, of Israel's relationship with the world. We're witnessing dramatic rise in anti-Israel sentiments, and I don't want to talk about the Gaza war because it's really a very weighty topic that I think exists independent of these events, in the sense that some people who might acknowledge the as I hope most rational people acknowledge the horrors of what happened on October 7th might have different views about how the war was carried out, but nevertheless, when we talk about perimeter security, there was clearly a massive failure of that on October the 7th. Fundamentally, huge numbers of Hamas, PIJ militants infiltrated Israel. I mentioned, I think, in a previous episode that one of my weird pastimes, because I think it tickled my interest in geopolitics and my enjoyment to travel, was visiting borders around Israel. And some of the border regions are the most fascinating parts of the country. I mean, it's a very small country, but places like Metula, I've been a number of times. And for anyone who wondered, why would you possibly do that? When I was growing up in Ireland, reading about the news in Israel, I'd love going on Google Maps and zooming in on the border. And then you just see that a border is, you know, it's a totally man-made construct. It's a line, and you have people sometimes just 200 or 300 meters across this invisible line whose lives are defined by the border. One's in Lebanon, one's in Israel. And the borders in Israel are very hard in the sense that Israel is kind of a geopolitical island. They're not, and they're borders between not only countries, but also ideologies. So when I finally got around to visiting places like Metula, we went down to the Egyptian border in row 10 and a bunch of other places. It was kind of like visiting places I've been looking at on Google Maps since I was 13. But if you want to see the border up close, there's a few places I could certainly recommend. Although I would caution that you want to pay very careful attention to the geopolitical climate of the day. But Metula is surrounded by Lebanon, basically, on all sides. And what I love about Metula is it's a pretty nondescript place. It's a small town. There's a terrific bar that has Le Chouf, for those who like the Belgian beer. And it's located about it might actually be my favorite bar in Israel. It's got that real winter tavern feel to it. And it's this quiet bar in a little village. And if you open Google Maps, you'll see you're actually sitting about 120 meters from the border fence. So it's kind of surreal. But I've had a few enjoyable stays in Metula. One of the creepy experiences actually was recording video when I was running my YouTube channel, and I documented, I think, my trip to Metula. We saw the Good Fence memorial, and I was recording B-roll, which is when you're kind of just filler shots in a YouTube video. And only when I got back to Jerusalem, when I was unloading my SD card and looking at what I shot, I noticed something I did not see with my eyes, which was a guy on the Lebanese side of the border with civilian clothing with a big gun. That was interesting. So it's really close, basically. Anyway, where were we? Borders, perimeter security. Yeah. So it really failed spectacularly in Gaza. My point about Lebanon was that when you get up close to the border, you realize that the actual physical border, the last line of defense, we talked about, maybe we didn't, but borders are pretty interesting how they actually work. In Israel's case, the border is usually before the border. So you have the international border, which as we talked about is defined with incredible precision to, down to the centimeter. And typically Israel will fence off the last, sometimes it's a few meters, sometimes it's 100 meters, and declare it a closed military zone. And that's where the border fence is. So beyond that, only the army can go. But that fence is still kind of the last line of defense. It's a physical fence. It might be smart, but it's ultimately a fence. It's a 2-3 meters high, let's say. In some places, I think everything's been delineated or it's physical fence everywhere now, but in some places it's less and more, serious of a fence, but it's a fence. And that fence dramatically failed on October 7th. Now, there's been a lot of recriminations about the tragic events of that day, but really, I guess what sort of gets me is, how is this even possible? Like, you would have thought, when I was probably looking at that fence in Matula many years ago, and I went down to the Gaza border as well, Nativa Asara, where tragedies occurred, and I guess I was just always thinking, couldn't someone just like drive through this fence or blast their way through the fence? And we always, if you ever looked into that topic, the kind of dark idea, you'd kind of say, well, there is the fence, kind of what we talked about, invisible perimeters. The fence is just a physical fence. It's a deterrent. There's extensive electronic surveillance. What October 7th proved is that when that failed, it was devastating. The fence literally was broken through, and that's how militants got into Israel. So I'm not sure where we want to go with this episode, Herman and Korn, but I think what I'd like to talk about is just how Israel's security was so devastatingly defeated on that day, because let's call a spade a spade. And I know it was a sophisticated attack. There was intelligence ignored, forward intelligence. There was decoys in rockets being sent into Israel in order to distract the attention of the military and leadership into thinking this was just another flare-up of missiles. There was drones that were taken out. There were surveillance cameras taken out, all at the same time. But ultimately, it was the fence that broke. So, Herman and Korn, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this painful chapter in Israel's history and what we can learn from it. A lot of commentary has been along the lines of, we learned about the hubris of over-reliance upon technical systems. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I don't think it's the complete picture of what we can think about. And as grim and horrible and tragic as that day was, I think it does a disservice to it if we don't do our utmost to learn all the lessons we can for it, whether we're talking about security in this national security context or anything really. So Herman and Courtney, let's talk about the painful events of October the 7th, 2023, which left a lasting scar in Israeli society. And what do you say, Herman and Korn, based on what you know? How did the fence fail? And what does it tell us or teach us about the mingling of advanced technical systems for protection and physical systems, and how they can be best utilized together without one being the only system or without relying entirely upon one part of the project?
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Korn, and I'm here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother. It is a bit of a rainy January afternoon here in 2026, and the city feels quiet today, but our topic is anything but quiet.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is good to be here, Korn, though I have to say, the topic our housemate Daniel sent over this week is a heavy one. He was asking about the events of October 7th, 2023. Specifically through the lens of perimeter security and how such a technologically advanced system could fail so catastrophically. It has been over 2 years since that day, and while the physical scars are healing in some places, the technical and strategic questions are still being debated in every engineering and military circle on the planet.
It is a question that has been at the center of national conversation here for years now, and Daniel really hit on something specific in his audio note. He was wondering how the integration of tech and physical barriers can be balanced so we do not end up relying too heavily on any one piece of the puzzle. It is a classic engineering problem with tragic, real-world consequences. How do you build a system that is smart but not brittle?
Exactly. And since we are sitting here in January of 2026, we actually have the benefit of several major investigations that have been released over the last year. Just yesterday, the Supreme Court actually lifted the gag order on that Asaf Shmulovitz case, which is a whole other layer of security breaches involving the command structure after the initial attack. Shmulovitz, for those who do not know, was the systems architect who warned about the fiber optic vulnerabilities back in 2022. But looking back at the border itself, the failure of what was called the Iron Wall is really a masterclass in what happens when you let technology create an illusion of invincibility.
The Iron Wall. I remember when that was completed in late 2021. It was marketed as this impenetrable barrier. 65 kilometers of reinforced concrete, sensors, and underground defenses. Herman, walk me through the technical side of that. What was actually in that wall that made everyone feel so safe? Because I remember the press releases. They made it sound like a sci-fi force field.
Right, so the Iron Wall was a 5 billion shekel project. That is about $1.1 to $1.5 billion depending on the exchange rate at the time. The vast majority of that budget, actually about 4 billion shekels, went into the underground portion. After the 2014 conflict, the big fear was tunnels. Hamas had been digging these sophisticated cross-border tunnels, and the Iron Wall was the ultimate answer to that. They built this massive underground slurry wall packed with seismic sensors that could detect even the slightest vibration of a shovel or a drill deep in the earth. It was designed to make the tunnel threat obsolete, and in many ways, it did. On October 7th, the tunnels were not the primary way they got through.
But that is part of the problem, right? By solving the underground problem so effectively, did they inadvertently signal to Hamas that they needed to go back to basics and just go over the top or through the fence? It is like if you lock your front door with 10 deadbolts. You are basically telling the burglar to try the window.
That is exactly what the 2025 IDF investigation concluded. It is called the risk paradox. The more you secure one avenue, the more you incentivize a high-risk, high-reward strategy on another. Above ground, the wall had a 6-meter-high fence, which was topped with cameras, thermal sensors, and something called Sentry Tech, or the C-Shoot system. These were remote-controlled machine gun stations that were supposed to allow operators back in a command center, miles away, to engage targets without ever putting a soldier in harm's way. The idea was that you could have a single operator managing several kilometers of border from a comfortable chair in a bunker.
I remember the Sentry Tech demos. It looked like something out of a science fiction movie. But on October 7th, those guns were neutralized almost immediately. How does a remote-controlled machine gun get defeated by a group that, on paper, has far less technical capability? Did they hack the software?
No, it was much simpler and more elegant than a hack. This is where the integration failure happened. Those Sentry Tech stations and the high-resolution cameras were all connected to a centralized network. The data was transmitted through cellular towers and fiber optic lines that ran along the border, often in very predictable paths. Hamas used small, off-the-shelf drones, specifically the Zawari fixed-wing drones and smaller quadcopters carrying basic explosives, to target the tops of those towers and the sensor clusters. By dropping a grenade on a communication relay or a camera lens, they essentially blinded the entire system. They did not need to hack the brain, they just poked the eyes out.
So, it was a classic single point of failure. You have the most advanced optics in the world, but if the wire connecting them to the screen is cut, they are just expensive glass and metal. It is like having a high-tech security system for your house that runs on a single Wi-Fi router sitting on your porch.
Precisely. And because the system was so automated, the IDF had reduced the number of physical troops on the border. They thought the technology acted as a force multiplier, meaning you need fewer boots on the ground because the eyes are everywhere. But when the eyes went dark, there was no one there to see the bulldozers moving in. The investigation found that the fence was breached in 119 different locations. 119. That is not a breach. That is a total structural collapse.
119. That is staggering. And we are not just talking about a few people crawling through. The reports say about 6,000 people crossed that day. It was a massive, coordinated surge. How long did it take them to actually get through the physical fence once the sensors were dead?
It was shockingly fast. It took only minutes for those bulldozers to tear down sections of the fence once the sensors were out. There is a common misconception that the fence was just a physical barrier. It was actually a detection system first and a barrier second. It was designed to tell you someone was there so you could send a tank or a helicopter. Once the detection was gone, the physical barrier was surprisingly flimsy against heavy machinery. They used snipers to take out the remaining cameras that the drones missed, and then the bulldozers just pushed the fence over like it was a garden gate.
This brings me back to Daniel's point about the integration of these components. If you have a physical barrier and a technical layer, they should ideally be redundant, not interdependent. But in this case, the technical layer was the brain, and the physical barrier was just the skin. Once the brain was concussed by those drone strikes, the skin did not have any muscle behind it to hold the line.
That is a great analogy, Korn. It is a failure of defense in depth. In security theory, defense in depth means you have multiple layers that do not rely on each other. If the cameras fail, you have the seismic sensors. If the seismic sensors fail, you have the human patrols. If the patrols fail, you have a physical wall that takes hours, not minutes, to breach. But the iron wall was designed as an integrated system where everything was fed into a single operational picture. When that picture went fuzzy, the whole command structure collapsed into what the reports called a fog of war that lasted for hours. The Gaza Division headquarters at Reim was actually one of the first places attacked, which meant the people who were supposed to fix the system were fighting for their lives.
And let us talk about the human element, because that is where the most painful parts of the reports live. The Tatzpitaniyot. For those who do not know, these are the female soldiers whose entire job is to sit in front of screens and watch the border feeds 24/7. They are the experts on every bush, every rock, every movement in their sector. They are the human heart of the technical system.
And they saw it coming. That is the most haunting part of the 2025 findings. Months before the attack, these lookouts were reporting unusual activity. They saw Hamas fighters practicing raids on mock-ups of Israeli kibbutzim. They saw them mapping the fence. They even reported seeing paraglider training. One lookout, whose testimony was recently declassified, said she reported a van driving along the fence every day at the same time to map the camera blind spots. But her reports were dismissed by higher-ups.
Why? Was it just arrogance, or was it a technical bias? Like, if the automated AI-driven alerts aren't screaming, then the human observation must be an exaggeration. We see this in aviation all the time, where pilots trust the autopilot even when the plane is stalling.
It was a mix. There was a concept called the conceptzia in Hebrew, which was the prevailing strategic assumption that Hamas was deterred and more interested in economic stability than a major war. But on a technical level, there was definitely a bias toward digital signals over human intelligence. The IDF had actually closed down its Hatzav unit in late 2021. That was the unit responsible for monitoring open-source intelligence like social media in Arabic. They thought big data and high-tech sensors could replace the nuanced understanding of human analysts. They were looking for a digital signature of war, but Hamas was planning a physical one.
It is the same mistake we see in Silicon Valley all the time. The idea that an algorithm can replace a subject matter expert. You can have all the SIGINT, which is signals intelligence, and ELINT, electronic intelligence, in the world. But if you lose your human intelligence, you lose the context. You might see the movement, but you do not understand the intent. If the AI sees 1,000 people training with paragliders and says this is a 0% probability of attack based on historical data, the human analyst should be able to say, yeah, but why are they doing it then?
Exactly. And the intent was hidden in plain sight. Hamas knew we were watching, so they used that against us. They conducted drills so frequently that the sensors and the analysts grew accustomed to the noise. It is the boy who cried wolf, but on a digital scale. The system was tuned to ignore routine movements, and Hamas simply made the preparations for a massacre look like routine movement. They even used flashbangs and small explosions near the fence for months to get the sensors used to the vibrations. By the time the real explosions happened at 6:29 a.m., the system just flagged it as more of the same.
So, when the attack actually started at 6:29 in the morning, the system did not just fail technically, it failed cognitively. The people in charge could not process that what they were seeing was real, because it contradicted everything their high-tech models told them was possible. It is like a computer crashing because it received an input it was told was impossible.
Right. The report mentions that the Gaza division was essentially defeated within the first few hours. Their command and control centers were targeted specifically because Hamas had mapped out where the fiber optic nodes and the communication hubs were. They did not just hit the border, they hit the central nervous system of the defense. They knew that if they took out the Rayyan base and the communication towers, the individual soldiers in the tanks and the bunkers would be isolated. And they were. For hours, many units had no idea that a full-scale invasion was happening. They thought it was just a localized skirmish.
This goes back to what we discussed in episode 151 about network reliability. If you have a centralized network, you have a giant target on your back. In that episode, we talked about how a mesh network is more resilient because there is no single point of failure. If the Gaza border security had been a mesh system where every camera and every gun could operate independently or talk to multiple hubs, those drones would have been a nuisance, not a knockout blow. Why wasn't it built that way?
Cost and complexity. It is much cheaper to run one big fiber line than to build a redundant mesh. But as we see now in 2026, the IDF is moving toward a more decentralized architecture for its border defenses. They are calling it the Smart Perimeter 2.0. The focus is actually on less integration in some ways. They want standalone systems that do not need a central server to function. If a camera sees a breach, it can trigger a local alarm or even a local defense mechanism without waiting for a handshake from a base 10 miles away. They are also adding analog backups. Things like physical tripwires that trigger flares, which cannot be jammed or blinded by a drone.
That is a huge shift in philosophy. It is almost a move toward edge computing in a military context. You process the data right there at the fence and act on it locally. But how do you balance that with the need for human oversight? You don't want autonomous machine guns firing at every stray dog that hits the fence. That is the ethical nightmare we have talked about before.
And that is the million-dollar question. The 2025 report suggests a tiered approach. You use the high-tech sensors for wide-area surveillance, but you maintain a heavy physical presence of humans who are empowered to make decisions. They are calling for a return to the old-school concept of a border guard where the person is the primary sensor and the technology is just a tool to help them see further. They are also re-establishing units like Hatzav to make sure they are listening to what people are saying, not just what the sensors are pinging.
It is interesting that the solution to a high-tech failure is often a return to human-centric systems. It reminds me of how some of the most secure facilities in the world still use physical keys and paper locks because they cannot be hacked from a distance. There is a certain dignity in the analog.
Totally. And there is a lesson here for anyone designing a security system, whether it is for a border or a data center. You have to assume the technology will fail. Not just that it might, but that it will. If your system requires 100% uptime of its technical components to be effective, then you do not have a secure system. You have a fragile one. Nassim Taleb talks about anti-fragility, systems that get stronger under stress. The Iron Wall was the opposite of that.
Fragility is the perfect word. The Iron Wall was brittle. It was incredibly strong until it reached a breaking point, and then it shattered completely. A more resilient system would have been one that could bend and degrade gracefully. If the cameras go down, the physical walls should still be enough to hold them for an hour. If the wall is breached, the local troops should be able to respond without waiting for orders from a blinded command center. We saw that individual heroism was what actually saved lives that day. It was the local security squads, the Kitokonat, in the kibbutzim who had to fight with whatever they had.
They were the ultimate redundancy. When the 5 billion shekel system failed, it came down to a few people with pistols and assault rifles holding the line. In places like Kibbutz Niram, the security coordinator, Inbal Liberman, recognized the sounds of the attack and mobilized her team before the official alerts even went out. She bypassed the system because her human intuition told her the system was wrong. That is the definition of a human-in-the-loop success, even in the midst of a systemic failure.
It is a sobering thought. All that investment, all that engineering, and it came down to the human will to survive. Daniel asks what this teaches us about the integration of these systems. I think the biggest takeaway is that technology should be an assistant, not a replacement. It should enhance human capability, not seek to automate it out of existence. When you automate a human out of the loop, you also automate out their ability to handle the unexpected.
Absolutely. And we need to be wary of the data. We get so much data now that we think we have total visibility. But visibility is not the same as understanding. We saw the same thing in the Spygear episode we did a few months back, episode 281. Just because you can see everything doesn't mean you know what you are looking at. You can have a 4K resolution video of your own demise, but if you don't believe it is happening, the resolution doesn't matter.
I remember that. We talked about how the sheer volume of surveillance data can actually create a blind spot because you cannot possibly process it all with the necessary depth. You end up relying on AI to filter it, and if the AI is trained on the wrong assumptions, like the assumption that Hamas is deterred, it will filter out the exact thing you need to see. It treats the signal as noise.
Which is exactly what happened with the Hamas drills. The AI saw them as routine. It had been trained to see them as routine, so it did not flag them as a threat. The humans who did flag them were told they were wrong because the data didn't support their gut feeling. This is a phenomenon called algorithmic bias, but in a tactical setting, we trust the math more than the man.
It is a tragic irony. The more advanced the system, the more likely we are to trust it over our own eyes. So, for the practical takeaways, if you are building a security system, whether it is for a country or a small business, how do you prevent this?
First, you need independent layers. Your communication network for your sensors should be separate from your command network. You need physical redundancies that do not require power or data to work. A thick wall is still a thick wall, even if the power is out. Second, you have to maintain a human-in-the-loop system where human intuition is given weight, even when it contradicts the data. You need a devil's advocate unit that actually has teeth.
The devil's advocate unit? That is a fascinating concept. I know the IDF has one, called Ipcha Mistabra, but the report said it had been sidelined leading up to 2023.
Yeah, it had shrunk to just a few people. Their job is specifically to look at the intelligence and argue for the opposite conclusion. If everyone says Hamas is deterred, their job is to prove they are not. But if leadership does not listen to them, they are just a box to be checked. For a system to be truly secure, you need a culture that rewards dissent and questioning. You need people who are paid to tell you that your 5 billion shekel wall is a waste of money.
That is a hard thing to build in any large organization, let alone a military. But the cost of not doing it is what we saw on October 7th. It is the cost of certainty in an uncertain world.
It really is. And as we look toward the future, the lessons from Gaza are being applied all over the world. We are seeing a rethink of border security in Europe and the United States. People are realizing that you cannot just build a smart wall and walk away. You have to live the wall. You have to be present. The technology is just a flashlight. You still need someone to hold it and someone to look where it is pointing.
I think about the people living in those communities today, in 2026. They are moving back, and the reconstruction is incredible. But the feeling of safety is different. It is not based on a wall anymore. It is based on the presence of soldiers and the knowledge that the system is being watched by eyes that are not just digital. It is a more cautious, more human kind of safety.
It is a hard-earned wisdom, and it brings up a broader point about our relationship with technology in 2026. We are so integrated now with neural interfaces and AI assistants in every part of our lives. But we have to remember that these are just tools. They are fallible because they are built by fallible people.
Fallibility is a human trait, but we have a tendency to think our machines are exempt from it. They are not. They are just as fallible as the people who programmed them and the data they were fed. If we forget that, we are just building bigger and more expensive points of failure.
Well said. I think we have covered a lot of ground here, from the technical specifics of drone-driven sensor failure to the psychological traps of the conceptsia. It is a lot to take in, but I think it is essential for understanding how to build a safer future. We have to respect the technology, but we have to trust the humans.
It definitely is. And I want to thank Daniel again for sending this in. It is a tough topic. Especially living here in Jerusalem, where the echoes of that day are still so present. But it is exactly the kind of deep dive we love to do on My Weird Prompts. We need to look at the failures to understand the successes of tomorrow.
Absolutely. And before we wrap up, I just want to say to everyone listening, if you've been following the show for a while, we really value your feedback. A quick rating or review on Spotify or whatever podcast app you use really helps the show reach new people who are looking for these kinds of deep dives. We are independent, and your support keeps the lights on.
It really does make a difference. We are at episode 284 now, and it's our listeners who keep us going. You can find all our past episodes and a contact form if you want to send us a prompt of your own at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We read every single one of them.
We'd love to hear from you. Whether it is a technical question about mesh networks or something completely out of left field, we are always looking for the next rabbit hole to jump down. No topic is too weird or too heavy for us to tackle.
Until next time, stay curious and keep questioning the systems around you. Don't just trust the dashboard, look out the window. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Thanks for listening. We will see you next week.
Take care, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.